Bad name, good sound.
Welcome to the first Bad Pod episode of the year, and this time we're setting sails into international waters. My name is Lauri Domnik, creative director for Bad Agency, and our guest today is a truly fascinating gentleman. All the way from New York, Steve Keller, creative strategy director at Studio Resonate. What makes this episode especially exciting is that our jobs are basically identical. You work in a creative audio strategy unit inside a major media company, Sirius XM's Studio Resonate, and I do the same here in Finland at Bauer Media's Bad Agency. So yes, we're doing the same work, just on different continents.
Right.
Steve, thank you for joining us, and a very warm welcome to Finland.
Thank you for having me. You know, I love these kind of cross-cultural exchanges, if you will, because we find that usually our businesses are far more alike than they're different.
Yeah.
And just trading ideas back and forth is the way that we grow, we learn, we solve problems, sometimes create more problems, but it's a relationship that I enjoy and love. So I appreciate just having the conversation today. We'll pretend like there's no cameras or nobody else listening in. And
exactly.
You and I will just enjoy ourselves.
You describe yourself as working at the intersection of science and art. What does that actually mean in practice?
It really kind of stems from my life journey in a way, you know, part of it being that I loved academia growing up. I was really interested in how our brains and our minds work. So when I went to university, I studied psychology. But music, art, had always been a part of my life too, as I was a child, playing the piano, picking up a guitar in high school, writing songs, basically because it was a fairly good dating tool. but I'd never thought about it as a career. And at one point, after I finished my university degree, I think I just gave myself permission to go down a different path. And I wound up in Nashville, started working in the music industry there, and eventually heard about this thing called sonic branding. And that was really my aha moment. It was a mixture of psychology and research, the science pieces with the art side of things. And, you know, the third part of that equation, the sound science, sound art, for me is sound thinking. So it's the blend of those two things that I try to bring into relationships with my clients, helping them understand how to think about sound and make choices that will be beneficial to them and their brands.
You have played hip-hop music to cheese over a long period of time to see if it changes the molecular structure of the cheese.
Yes.
Would you categorize this as science or art?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, look, we both work in the world of advertising.
Yeah.
And as much as I love science, as a scientist and as I like to say, a pracademic, you know, practicer of the academic arts, I also am a marketer. And I understand the value of a really sexy story.
Yeah.
So just saying, playing hip-hop music to cheese to see if you can change its molecular structure.
That's cool.
Yes, it's it's very cool. And so this was an engagement from Kellogg, where we had an opportunity to work with their advertising agency, Leo Burnett, on this idea of using sound to change the flavor of cheese. And we were able to do that. They turned our sonically aged cheese into a special limited edition box of Cheez-It. We had a hip-hop playlist on Pandora that went along with the promotion. And it was very successful. Last year, we actually won a Grand Best of the Best Effie, one of 14 campaigns in the world that won that. So it was,
congratulations.
It was
on that.
Thank you. And it was really effective for the client. So that's what I love. When
exactly.
I can play with sound and it's so effective with the client, and you know, the team at Studio Resonate does that so well. And I'm just privileged to be able to do what I do and be able to have a roof over my head and put food in my mouth.
So the cheese was actually good.
Yes, we had a blind taste test
to
just make sure if we validated the change. I had set aside a piece of control cheese that didn't have exposure to the music, and across the panel in the blind taste test, the aroma, the flavor, and the aftertaste of the cheese was definitely different. You know, just as a side note, what we were really playing with was vibration there.
Obviously.
You know, sound is about vibration. Yeah. When cheese is aging, you have microorganisms that are developing. So it was the consistent vibration for 6 months that changed the way those microorganisms developed. And as a result, it changed the flavor and the aroma of the cheese.
The cheese wasn't offended by the lyrics of the hip-hop
music. It did not seem to be. No, not at all.
You're not just playing hip-hop music to cheese, and you're not just talking about ads. You're talking about experience, interventions, identities. How do you define the full scope of what we call sonic strategy?
For me, you know, when I look at sonic strategy, I'm usually looking at three things. And again, this goes back to, you know, using our brains, which is why another one of my pithy statements is that sonic strategy doesn't start with your ears. It starts with what's between them.
Yeah.
So in thinking about how we represent brands in the world sonically, you know, we sometimes focus more narrowly on sonic identity, how we might use sound to create a perception of the brand, or sonic advertising and marketing, typically what we think about when we have an audio advertisement in a channel. But when you zoom back, you find that there's such a broad range of places to touch consumers. And I think sonic identity has evolved beyond just an asset, which we may talk about a little bit later, but is more about an experience. Yeah. So things like Cheez-It, where, you know, we can engage consumers in an interesting way with sound that they're not used to. I do a lot of work with cross-modal science, the way our senses work together. And I've been privileged enough to work with academics like Charles Spence at Oxford in playing with how we can change perception of flavor using sound. So these experiences move beyond advertising and engage consumers. And then the last area that you mentioned is this idea of interventions. And to me, that's going even a step further, where we're reaching beyond just product benefits and excitement and advertising, but maybe looking at culture and communities. And how can we look at sound as perhaps a way to solve a problem that might exist, whether that's kind of looking at how do we represent a diversity of cultures in advertising with sound. We think about that in terms of seeing, but what about sound? What about health and wellness or particular classes of individuals like neurodivergence and you know, how we might use sound as an intervention there. So I think these are all just touch points where it touches us all personally and professionally and in our communities. And I think brands can participate in all of those things.
Absolutely.
Sonically.
Miles Davis said, and you refer to his quote quite often, "Don't play what's there, play what's not there."
Right.
How does that mindset shape your work in sonic creativity?
Well, I think, you know, that quote from Miles to me sums up what creativity really is. You know, it's very often taking something that we encounter every day and reframe it in a way that is surprising.
Yeah.
It's almost magical, if you will. And I think that we can bring more of this thinking to bear, particularly in marketing, where we're consumed by data and we have availability for more data points. And look, I'm a science guy. I love data. But I think far too often we are so focused on the data and we believe that the data is an insight, and it's not. The insight is what happens when you take those dots and try to connect them or disconnect them in interesting ways. So, you know, as per Miles's quote, I think the most amazing pieces of work that I've done have come because we found something interesting that took us down a road we never expected. Mm. And we were able to play what wasn't there instead of just concentrating on what was there.
Mm. You already mentioned quoting yourself.
Yeah, I quote myself a lot.
Sound doesn't start with our ears. It right. starts with what's between them.
Yeah.
So it's basically all about the brain.
Yes.
What happens in the brain when we hear brand sounds? And what do you think makes some sonic cues stick and others disappear instantly?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you and I could talk all day. Mm-hmm. You know, we just turn the cameras off and go have a drink and dive into that because there's so much there. But just to kind of touch on some of the highlights, you know, I mean, we are so literally wired for sound. Sound gets into our ears and our neural pathways much faster than visual input. We process it a lot faster. Our reflex reaction to it is much faster. And the dopamine, the oxytocin, the cortisol, all the chemicals in our brain that are fired when we hear things are really powerful.
I actually did a presentation on this, what happens to a human when we fall in love.
Yes.
And you can simulate all those effects.
Exactly.
With sound.
Yes.
Which is amazing to me. All the same hormones, you can yes. touch them and you can really make a difference.
Yes. Which it's not surprising that if we consider our relationships, there probably are sonic elements that go with those things.
Yeah.
The sound of someone's voice that we love, a piece of music that might have been playing the first time that we met someone. All of these things become triggers for us. And so it's not just the sight of a loved one, it's that sound. I mean, think about a child developing in the womb. And as our sense of hearing develops, you're not only hearing the heartbeat of the mother and the voice of the mother, but you're hearing sounds and cues in the environment. So already there, we're beginning to be primed and sensitized. And that leads to emotions and an emotional reaction. And then there's the perception piece, as I talked about, with sound where we can hack other senses, the meaning that sound gives to us, and then certainly the behavioral aspect of that. And so with the memories and all of that that's developed, you know, it's like I think sound is the first sense to arrive and it's the last sense
to leave.
Yeah,
exactly.
Another one of those pithy comments.
Before we get to my actual next question, could you please explain the System 1 and System 2 idea, which you refer to in many of your talks?
Yes, this is an idea from Daniel Kahneman, who looked at this idea that our brains are processing sound in different ways. You know, some people talk about right brain, left brain. I mean, we know from the research that there's a little bit of a myth around the idea that our right brain is doing one thing and our left brain is doing another. It's, you know,
it's
our brains
very much simplified.
Yes, exactly. Our brains are working together, but the different hemispheres of the brain are processing in a different way. And so what Daniel had theorized and what we've seen in a lot of the research is that there is this system one, which is kind of more at an unconscious level where we respond to things in terms of the emotions, the undercurrents that we're not always aware of. And system two is a little bit more on the surface. You know, we might think about it as being a little more rational. Mm. And again, I want to be cautious that we don't pit, you know, emotion against logic. That's not what this is at all. But there is a way in which there's a surface level, if you will, think of it as an iceberg. And what's happening on the top of the surface is that system two. And what's happening underneath, which is very often the larger part of the iceberg, that's system one.
So now that we're clear with the two systems, why do you think so many marketers are still stuck optimizing for system two, for the rational?
Because it's easier to measure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, going back to measurement and metrics, look, we live in a world where businesses are continually having to justify, you know, spending money, making decisions. And those are driven by measurement. And these short-term measures are the easiest and the most immediate
way to keep your job.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
To make the shareholders happy.
Yeah.
You know, so in this pursuit of performance and short-term metrics, you know, we tend to focus more on the rational, and we start looking at things like targeting. That targeting is very much a system two approach. We look at rational benefits of the brand. Certainly, physical availability is part of that. How do we make sure that it's there? And all of those things are much easier to measure than the system one effects, where we're really talking about brand building. We're talking about broad reach. You know, broad targeting, if you will. We're talking about that emotional connection that builds over time, and the mental availability that you need. You can still measure those things, but you have to measure it over time. And sometimes, you know, the CMOs that have a shelf life of maybe 2 or 3 years, if they're lucky, they don't feel like they have the luxury of time to really measure those things. So in pursuit of those metrics, we've pursued short-term solutions. And all the marketing research has shown us that that's detrimental to the brand. Now, not to say that performance marketing isn't important. It is.
Of course it is. Yeah.
But it's always about a balance, just like system one, system two.
Yeah.
You know, but what we find is, get system one right, and then what you're doing with system two is going to be amplified even more. Same thing, get your brand building right, and that performance marketing is going to be amplified in terms of the returns there.
Our work-life culture is pretty much driving us to measure and do the wrong things.
Yes. Yeah.
It's kind of worrying.
Yes, totally. And I think, you know, I like to talk about measuring the meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where sometimes we, you know, again, we get stuck in there's certain metrics that we're always going for, that we're looking at. Yep. I can't tell you how many times I get a brief from a client, and at the top, there's the one section where they're talking about the problem they're trying to solve and what they're wanting to do. And then you get down to how are we going to measure KPIs?
Yeah.
And often there's a disconnect between what they're saying they want to do and how they're measuring.
Yeah.
It's totally a wrong metric. And so we don't even stop to ask the question, what is meaningful and how do we measure that?
Yeah.
We just default to, okay, I've got my checklist of things that I can measure and how I can do it, so I'm just going to plug this in and, you know, hope that those numbers somehow tell a good story.
Exactly. You already said that we are going to dive into sonic assets, small sounds with big effects.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, just for clarity, could you briefly explain sonic assets or sonic cues? What do they actually mean?
Well, yes, as briefly as somebody like me can do it. A brand has what we call distinctive assets. These are things that they lean into that you can make associations with the brand so that you try and recognize that brand more immediately. Usually when we think about these assets, they're visual in nature. You know, you see a brand logo, maybe there are colors, there might be a certain kind of typography that's associated with the brand, where packages are put together. And so a sonic asset is, as it sounds, it's the acoustic version of that. So like a sonic logo is to the ear what a visual logo is to the eye. So it's a combination of sounds or notes that create a very quick way to recognize and identify a brand. And I'm sure we'll chat about this a little bit more in a minute, so I won't take too much time here. But I think one of the things that folks don't stop to think about when they talk about distinctive assets of any kind, but Sonic in particular, is that that distinctiveness isn't simply about the sound. Mm. It's about the consistency of use and application of that sound. So someone can spend a lot of time attempting to craft the right sound, and certainly they can stack the deck with things that are a little bit more memorable than others. But at the end of the day, it's then the brand practice, the adherence to guidelines, the consistent use that builds memory and makes that asset distinctive.
Mm. Ipsos data suggests that sound cues are 8.5 times more likely to drive brand salience than many visual assets. And this is just one of many studies. Yes. I mean, there are several ones that prove the same point. Why do you think, with all this evidence, that sound is still so underused in branding? Do we once again get back to the same conversation about what we are measuring, what we're trying to achieve in the short term, or are there other reasons as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've been doing this work for a long time. And anybody that I talk to that's been doing this work, this is the biggest question, the biggest barrier, the biggest hurdle to get over. Mm. How do we change this conversation about the value of sound?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know that the answer is simple, that there's any silver bullet. You know, I think one of the things that's problematic with sound is that we all know what we like. So very often, you know, dealing with clients with sound, it's like everybody's an expert. It's hard to disassociate the things that we like. And again, sound moves us emotionally. So, you know, it's one thing to be developing a visual and, you know, does it fit? Does it not fit? Okay, I get it. I don't. You might have an emotional reaction, but nowhere near as strong as with sound. So it can be difficult to make decisions.
Yep.
Then you've got the creative aspects around sound, and that creatives are always looking for ways to evolve, to change. There's this idea that, well, if I have a distinctive sonic asset that I'm using everywhere, does that mean I can no longer use a different piece of music if I want to? Or what if I'm having to change this emotion or that emotion? So even sometimes on the creative side, you get pushback. And then you have, you know, we were talking about CMOs and how they have a short shelf life. And very often when agencies come in and they want to do something different, you know, they're usually not going to walk in and say, we want to change your logo.
Yeah.
But it could be, well, we want to use a different voiceover. We want to change the tonality of sound. And because people aren't as invested or understand the value, it becomes easier to change. And I think the last piece of it is just that through the years, we've developed, particularly on our advertising agencies, what's sometimes kind of a systemic bias against sound. You know, back in the early days of radio, before there were televisions, I mean, this was theater of the mind,
you
know, branded content, sponsored shows, even before they were called that, that was happening. The old school jingles, all of that was standard practice. And then television comes along and movies, and that's so much more exciting. And, you know, who doesn't fancy themselves a director that wants to work with a brand that has a budget and they can go out and do this big film? And yes, there's sound associated with that, but we started leaning so much into visuals and forgetting sound. And what often happens is then sound becomes the domain of, we've got a radio spot. Here's an opportunity for that young copywriter to work on that because, you know, it's not as important as this big film over here. And so all of those things put together just, you know, result in this lack of thinking about sound at the beginning of the process and leaving it to being an afterthought when at that point it's really hard to make changes or to do something astounding and different.
So in a sense of marketing and branding, video did kind of kill the radio star.
Yes. Yeah. I think that it actually did. But I'm heartened that you know, there are more and more conversations. You know, in the early days of this work when I was doing this, there were very few companies that were actually measuring audio. You know, the closest you would get to a measure of audio was in a television commercial when a question was asked, did you like the music choice?
Yeah.
You know, which really wasn't that helpful because if people liked it, it's like, okay, well, how do I do that again? Yeah. And if people hated it, it was like, well, what do I need to do different? Yeah. But now we've gotten much more sophisticated. So, you know, again, we have metrics. So that becomes a little more attractive. People feel like they can lean into things a little bit more. We can A/B test. You know, we're beginning to have more and more discussions around the power of these sonic assets because of research like Ipsos, like you just said, and some of the things that System One, not the System One thinking, but System One, the measurement group, is doing on their end that's really helping move this conversation forward.
Yeah.
But it's still difficult to move it from the back half of the process to get to where people, you know, engage in what I call audio first thinking. Yep. That doesn't mean, oh, I'm going to start by thinking about an audio ad. Mm-hmm. No, it's just simply, where is audio in the process of what you're creating and how can it drive your brand in the same way, if not more, than a visual approach or a packaging approach or any of the other approaches you might have.
In Finland, about 34% of the top 200 advertisers use at least one consistent sonic element in their marketing. What would you say to the other 66% who still remain anonymous to the ears?
Look, you know, what happens when people close their eyes? You know, I think, again, it's coming back to looking at the measurement and looking at the additive power. You know, we're not talking about saying, stop doing television commercials. Mm-hmm. You know, not at all. What we're saying is, if you've got a television commercial, I dare say there's probably sound that's associated with it.
And roughly 50% of people who are actually not watching your commercial but are hearing it.
Yes. And so you've already spent money. You know, this was actually an aha moment for me early in my career as I started concentrating more on audio branding. And, you know, I'd often go in and you know, in meeting with brands and particularly CMOs, talking about the creative angle.
Yeah.
But there was one day I went in, and I don't even know what prompted me to ask the question, but I just said, how much money did you spend on audio last year? And kind of scratched his head, and he said, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably all just tied into the advertising budget.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, okay. Well, then what are your audio KPIs? And he said, audio KPIs, what's that? I said, well, I'm sure you have a KPI for everything, right? You're spending money on audio already. How are you measuring those returns? And the engaging in that conversation totally shifted, you know, what we talked about after that. Mm. And so I think, you know, for these brands that aren't leaned into audio, if you want to talk about efficiency, if you want to talk about cost controls, this is a place to do it because you're already using music. You may have thought about a piece of music. Maybe you've licensed something. Maybe there's a voiceover. Step back and look at all the places in your ecosystem you're reaching consumer ears and think about, oh, how do I connect the dots here so I'm efficiently using the sonic properties that are then not only benefiting me in terms of cost controls, But now I'm creating these memory structures because people are interacting sonically with my brand everywhere. So I still don't get it when brands don't lean in. But we've got things that I think can strengthen the argument.
I think personally in my work, one of the most important things that we tend to forget is exactly this, that audio doesn't stop
right
at the ad.
Yeah.
So in your opinion, what are some of the most overlooked touch points where sound could be doing more for a brand that are now less used?
On hold. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if you've experienced this, but very often
I think everyone has.
Yeah, I work with brands all the time that, you know, very often are really intentional in all these other channels, but God forbid you get put on hold and you have entered into an entirely different sonic universe.
Yeah.
And look, if somebody is calling into your brand, and you know, let's be honest, it's getting harder and harder to do that these days, they're in a particular mindset.
Yeah.
You know, and here's an opportunity to reach them in that moment using psychology to understand probably what that mindset is and using sound in a way that can actually build a connection and have a positive response. So, you know, that's one of the first areas that I would look at. And then it's all these other areas in terms of what are the touch points, you know, is there an opportunity with your packaging to make a sound? Does the product itself make a sound that you can lean into for equity? Is it a retail environment? Is there something at point of sale that you can bring into place? And that's a part of the process, as you well know, often just starting with a brand, doing a series of audits.
Yeah.
So a contextual audit where it's like, where are all of these touch points that we can reach? And then how do we prioritize there? Because I think the priorities for different brands are going to be different.
Yeah, definitely. In my opinion, personally, I would say customer spaces.
Yeah.
I mean, you can do so much with so little. We had this mall here in Helsinki, a big shopping center, right in the heart of Helsinki, where we designed a soundscape for the shopping center. And we measured it for months, doing A-B testing mm-hmm. between the background music that used to play before and the soundscape. And we noticed that on the days that the soundscape played, customers stayed 8.5% longer. 8.5% longer in a shopping center is 10% in sales,
yes.
Which was tens of millions yes. of euros per year,
mm-hmm.
just by thinking what comes out of the speakers. So every time I'm walking around in the city, it's like I only hear missed opportunities.
Yes. Well, and you know, look, one of the fun examples for me on this particular trip was landing in Helsinki and going to the WC and hearing the bird song.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's there. As I've been walking around the city today, it's a very sonically pleasant
yeah.
place. And I notice, you know, sound in these spaces. You know, food brands, restaurant brands. I mean, that's another one.
You yeah.
know, the whole noise level in restaurants, the choice of music in restaurants, all of those things that are contributing or distracting from the ritual of eating have really powerful effects. All the way from a noisy restaurant, the food is not as flavorful.
Yeah.
It just isn't because of what the sound is doing. And then that noise level increases our appetite. So we see in noisy areas of cities a little higher incidence of obesity.
Mm.
You know, what happens in a noisy restaurant with alcohol consumption? People drink more alcohol.
Yeah.
And as a result of drinking more alcohol, as you start to get drunk, you begin to lose your high-end hearing. What does that mean? Everyone's talking louder. What does that do to the restaurant? It gets loud. So, you know, you start talking about all of these things and pulling on these threads, and it becomes, again, being able to be really intentional and do even small things that can have a big impact, as you just said, when you look at the potential of what happens with just a few more seconds of shopping time.
Yeah. Let's have a quick dive into AI.
Sure.
I'm going to ask you, maybe in a bit of a provocative way, should every brand discard their voiceovers, change to AI speakers, discard composers and musicians and change to AI music, or what should they do? Because it is, eventually, I mean, you can get it so much cheaper.
Oh, yeah. Look, there's a lot of ways to slice that question, but maybe let me speak to it, again, kind of going back to the science side, because we've been testing AI, and particularly human and AI voices, for the last 2 years. You know, as a caveat, I think we rush forward in the application of things because it's exciting. We look at the potential for cost cutting and efficiencies, as you said. You know, perhaps it's because of my background in the behavioral sciences. I'm actually less concerned with the application. I'm more concerned with the implication. You know, what happens to culture, what happens to workflows, what happens to effectiveness. And I feel very often we have sacrificed effectiveness on the altar of efficiency.
Yeah.
And it's not that those two things, again, can't work together. There always has to be a balance. But, you know, the direct answer to your question is no, I don't think every brand should, you know, hop on the AI train. You know, just like there's always a question, particularly, you know, in creative circles, is AI going to take my job? You know,
and, no.
And yeah, that my answer to that, and you know, this is not something I've come up with, but is no, AI is not going to take your job. But somebody who knows how to use AI probably will.
Yes, yeah.
So, you know, I think what brands and creatives, any of us, should be doing is we should be playing with these tools. We should be seeing what their limitations are, how we can stretch and push and pull with them. But specifically in the world of advertising, there's a few things here. I mean, to be honest, when it comes to AI-generated music, we won't even touch that. I mean, I would right now, across the board, say to any advertiser, stay away from any AI generated music.
Thank you, Steve.
You know, and part of that is from a legal perspective.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of questions around that. There's a bias perspective that I'll address in just a moment that can have, you know, a result in a brand having bad perceptions from consumers. And then there's the piece that's really close to home for me as, you know, a composer working at one point in my life, and a lot of my friends who are composers and create music, you know, AI slop, as we like to call it, is a real problem.
Yeah.
You know, these AI tools, in some ways, it's wonderful. It's democratized the ability for people to create.
Yeah.
You know, but I often compare it to the, you know, the kindergarten when the teacher says, who here is a singer? And everybody raises their hand.
Yeah.
Who here is an artist? And everybody raises their hand. The tools give all of us an opportunity to do some things that maybe we didn't have the capacity to do before. And in the hands of a true artist, AI can augment that process. But because AI has democratized sound, there are thousands and thousands of AI music tracks that are generated every day.
Yeah.
And it's becoming harder and harder to keep them off of platforms. You know, I think our team at Pandora has done a really good job with trying to tweak our algorithms to recognize AI, yeah, to pull AI, yeah, off. But I know how difficult it is.
And it gets, yes, more difficult every day.
Yeah. And the end result of that for creatives is that, you know, there's only so many hours in a day, and music that's playing in those hours are generating a performance royalty,
yeah,
that's really important to the creators.
Mm.
Well, with AI, there's still questions around who owns that to begin with. And the more that AI eats into this pie, the less revenue that's there for the creators to create. So that's the implication. So that's on the music side. On the voice side, what we found over the last 2 years is, if we ask people if they can tell the difference between an AI and a human voice, the majority of them will say, well, yes, of course.
Yeah.
But then when we actually test it, 2 years ago, it was a flip of the coin, 50-50 chance they'd, yeah, get it right. A year ago, when we did some of the same kind of testings, only 38% of the audience correctly identified AI and human voices. But even though we have a hard time telling a difference, there's still something that's happening on that system one side.
Yeah.
You know, so when we tested from a neuro standpoint, trust and positivity with voices, we found that the AI voices, they actually tested really well. So it's not that they, you know, that they're negative on either of those,
yeah,
things, you know, particularly for a performance-based ad where you just, you know, you don't need to make an emotional connection.
Yeah.
But human voices tested significantly better for trust and positivity.
Yeah.
So if you're a brand where that's really important, on that system one level, you don't want to mess with that. Now, as we've gotten into cloning voices, we've seen that gap, you know, begin to get smaller and smaller. The tools just keep getting better. But there's still something on that brand building, emotional connecting side where a human voice still has power over AI. And then there's this bias piece that I talked about.
Mm.
You know, one of the things that we did in the research was we primed some of our panelists by saying, you're going to hear an ad with an AI voice. And then we asked questions about the ad, or, you know, had ways of them performing so we could get more at a system one level. And what we found was if we primed our panelists with that question, the AI voices were rated lower.
Yeah.
In fact, we would play human voices and tell them that it was AI, and we would see the trust and positivity in that human voice,
yeah,
drop. So there was a bias against AI use.
Yeah.
And a year later in the second study, not only did that remain, but we actually started dividing up, slicing the data with demographics. And what was interesting to me, that this negative sentiment with AI was being driven by younger consumers. 18-year-old to 35 was really kind of driving this negative sentiment. So this is a real problem in terms of transparency.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a question of, can I use AI for efficiency, but how do you disclose that? And if we get to a point where a government says you have to disclose if you're using AI,
yeah,
how do you do that in audio?
Yeah.
With a disclaimer at the end, right?
Yeah.
When you hear those disclaimers, what do you usually think? Oh, well, there's something bad about this.
Yeah, exactly.
That they're telling me. And if every audio ad that's using an AI voice is going to have one of those, that's going to be a problem. So I'll wrap this up by saying our solution, in attempting to bridge this gap between efficiency and effectiveness, is to say that we can get the best of both worlds by working with our human talent, coming up with equitable agreements where we can clone their voice. The talent still has an agency to be able to say, you can use my voice for this, but not, yep, for that. We work out a fair exchange rate so that if the clone is used, they're benefiting still. And then we use the clone for those elements where maybe there's multiple price points that we have to change, or a dynamic situation with multiple stores. So you get the benefits of the human read,
yep,
the efficiencies of dropping in the clone voice, and everybody's still happy. And so currently, that's been our approach, and it seems to be working well.
I love what you said right at the beginning of this AI talk. We're sacrificing effectiveness.
Yeah, on the altar of efficiency.
On the altar of efficiency. Last question, Steve. Yeah. If a Finnish brand came to you tomorrow and said, we want to sound unforgettable, what's the first thing you would ask them?
Are you willing to go the distance?
Steve, thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to you listening or watching this episode of The Bad Pod. Tune in for another episode next month. And meanwhile, say, let's make sound decisions.
Yes. Thanks, Laurie. Appreciate being here. And thanks to everyone listening in.